Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7 with authors, editors, agents, poets, those connected with the art or the business of writing. Tonight my guest is mystery author Julie Smith, and she's here to talk about writing and about 82 Desire, her eighth Skip Langdon novel. Julie Smith is a former reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the San Francisco Chronicle. Her first Skip Langdon novel, New Orleans Morning, won the Edgar Award given by the Mystery Writers of America for Best Novel, making her the first American woman to win the award in that category since 1956. As a professional journalist, Julie Smith approaches each book like a reporter, meticulously researches each story in the Skip Langdon series. She has enrolled in the Oakland Citizen Police Academy, been a chef, participated in 12-step programs, and traveled to Southwest Louisiana to trace damage done by hurricanes. After many years in California, Smith has returned to New Orleans, where she lives in an 1830s Creole townhouse with its very own ghost and serial murder story. Julie, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Barbara.
82 Desire was quite a page-turner. What inspired you to write about corporate crime in the late 1990s?
Well, actually, you know, it's one of those things that kind of comes out of your own life. I started thinking about it because my husband was working with a company, which I will call Company B, which had been bought from a Company A. And it turned out that Company A had... Actually, they had cooked the books, and this was a company that was supposed to be making money, and it really wasn't. And not only had they cooked the books, but they had their own mole inside the company, which managed to cover it up, or who managed to cover it up for about 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
I was absolutely outraged. As we watched the story unfold, he would come down every day, or come home every day, and tell me what was happening. And when it came to light, what really shocked me was that the owners of Company A didn't sue, they didn't press charges, they didn't do anything. They just let it go. And that let me know how common this must be.
Hmm. Did being a reporter help you to be a mystery writer?
Oh, I think it helped a lot, yeah. The first thing it does is it teaches you not to be afraid of a blank page,
mm-hmm.
or I really should say a blank screen, but when I first started, we had pages, which I think is every writer's problem. Every writer has a problem being afraid. And when you have to make a deadline every day, sometimes several times a day, you kind of get over that fear. One of the best pieces of advice I ever had came from a city editor, who didn't mean it as good advice. He meant it as, you know, do this or get fired. And what he said was, don't get it right, get it written.
Mm.
I really thought that was funny.
That's
anyway, so it helped me that way. And the other thing is that I learned to research,
mm-hmm.
which I think, well, to me it's very important, even if you write fiction. Our stories may take place in a parallel universe, but it should be a universe that makes sense according to this one.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Why mysteries? Were you more of a crime reporter and you naturally found yourself there, or had you always been a mystery reader?
I've always been a mystery reader. Yeah, I never even read Nancy Drew. I don't know why, but I never found her. I went straight to Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
I managed to find some Sherlock Holmes stories when I was about 12, and that just got me hooked.
Will you please read a couple of pages of 82 Desire to give our listeners a taste of what you're writing?
Sure, I will. Most of my books begin, because I write about New Orleans, I like to begin them with really a little essay about the city itself to kind of set the stage. So what you're going to hear is not going to be full of blood and guts and finding a body, but more a setting the stage kind of thing.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. New Orleans changes people, even if they only come for a weekend. The expected occurs. Teetotalers get sloshed, virgins get laid. But the consequences are sometimes lasting and large. The story is told, for instance, about the woman who came to Jazz Fest and faxed her husband goodbye, a long-running husband, too. The city's a setup. The very air smells different. You notice it as you step off the plane. There's a hint of mildew, heavy with history. Then, if it's the right season, there's also jasmine and sweet olive. Urine and vomit as well, along with plenty of pine salt to take the edge off. In the bars, 100 years of cigarette smoke. In the streets, frying oysters from restaurant vents. Sweat, vodka fumes, pheromones. In the spring, the air is more like velvet than silk, luxuriant but a little smothery. In summer, it lies on the body like 3-inch fur, tangled fur. The very name New Orleans conjures up the sense of another century. Riverboat gambling, black marketeering, bordello revelry, wicked skullduggery, and relentless scalawaggery. Today, the city's gamblers wear oversized T-shirts instead of ruffles. Its black marketeers are drug dealers, its prostitutes, transvestites, and underage addicts. Skullduggery institutionalized. But everyone wants in on the scalawaggery. The name conjures up Southern graciousness as well. This exists today behind the elegant facades of the French Quarter and the iron fences of the Garden District. Yet it is beginning to fade at some of the city's landmark restaurants. Lately, jeans have been seen amid the dark wood and white linen of old-line eateries. On the streets, sartorial standards are a plain disgrace. Men think nothing of taking off their shirts as if it were the beach. Tourists urinate on the 19th-century townhouses. Angry residents will sometimes stop to chastise them, but the tourists answer that if the Quarterites don't like it, they should move to the suburbs. The tourists peek through the iron grills at the lush courtyards, and who can blame them for that? But they do not draw the line at mixing drinks on the residents' stoops. Gutter punks are drawn to the Quarter as hippies were drawn to the Haight-Ashbury, yet they will move along if asked. They have chosen lives on the fringe, and they know the consequences of crossing the line. It's the tourists who give lip. Ladies who call the cops if a stranger touched weary butt to their own immaculate steps will argue that in the Quarter, surely everything is public. They're weekend outlaws and proud of it. On weekends, living in the French Quarter can be like camping out in the middle of Disneyland. Yet around midnight, if nobody's driving by playing rap at full volume, mules clip-clop on the streets, ships whistle on the river. You could swear it's 100 years earlier, though you know the boats are full of petroleum products and the mules are trudging home after a hard day of hauling tourist buggies. At about 3 or 4 a.m., the drunks commence to shouting and the paper thuds on the balcony. Sometime after, quiet descends. Then at 8 Monday morning, people open their shutters and greet their neighbors. You hear them up and down the streets. Good morning, Alice. Good morning, Don. So civilized. So very 19th century. And for 5 days, until the tourists arrive for the next weekend, the Quarter is the closest thing to a European village this country has to offer. Well, Barbara, I lived there in the French Quarter, as you might imagine.
Yes. It's wonderful. I really, really like the whole book so much.
Thank you so much.
And if you who are listening have just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with mystery author Julie Smith. Julie, one of the things I very much liked about 82 Desire was your use of multiple viewpoint. You have 4 point of view characters, which is a difficult thing to pull off as well, as masterful, actually, as you have. Will you talk about why you did this?
Yes, I had been writing years ago. I wrote a series in the first person, and I really enjoyed it. But there came a time when I wanted to look at things in different viewpoints. And so I began the multiple viewpoint idea actually with the first Skip Langdon novel. And in that book, I wanted to have the cop, Skip, I wanted to be in her viewpoint, and then I wanted to be in the viewpoints of the suspects as well. Now this one, 82 Desire, is slightly different because it's written from the viewpoint of 2 other investigators. One is a private eye, and one is a newspaper reporter. And then there are a couple of other male viewpoints as well. But I really enjoyed doing that because you could see the case converge. You could see it coming together in 3 different ways at the same time. That was fun. The other thing is it allows you to look at the world through through different eyes. Mm-hmm. One of the fun things about it is people can see the detective. They can actually look at Skip, and they can have different opinions about her. So that you, the reader, have to make up your own mind what she's really like.
Mm-hmm. Is this also a way to create suspense in terms of, you know, cutting from one character to another?
Yes, yes. I think it works very well that way. Yeah, it can, you know, you can almost do the Perils of Pauline kind of idea and leave a cliffhanger and go to the next viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. What about plotting and outlining? The book has so many layers, it would seem that you did quite a bit of that with 82 Desire.
Well, I confess that I do that.
Do you spend
there are
like
many writers who can sit down and just write, and you know, it's wonderful. But
how involved do you get in outlining?
Well, I am a big believer in it, for the simple reason that it terrifies me to think of not knowing where I'm going. I think maybe it's all those years of journalism. I always had a notebook full of notes. So what I do when I begin a book is I have kind of a germ of an idea. In this case, I had the idea of corporate crime. And I often start, actually with all the Skip Langdon novels, I start with a myth or a piece of a myth or an important story. And I kind of hang the story on that. This book has a David and Goliath theme.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has a little bit of Hamlet in it. So I may start with those two ideas. In this one, I had corporate crime, David and Goliath. Well, obviously, that lends itself very well, right? Corporation is a big Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I start from there, and I start to see my characters. And I begin to see who they are and whose viewpoint I would like to tell the story in. And then I begin to tell the story. I work with the characters for a bit. And then, meaning for a day or two, you know, but that's only the beginning of working with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I begin to outline. And that takes me from 2 weeks to a month and is a very, very detailed process and absolutely maddening. I'm really not much fun to be around when I'm doing that. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, plotting. But the beauty of it is, once you've got it done, then you have the rest of the year to write your book in peace. You don't have to get up and be miserable every
mm-hmm.
day.
So that will you stray from what your outline has you doing, or do you stick to it religiously?
Well, I do stray if it seems important to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to happen or is it?
How long does a book take, then, once you have your outline done?
Oh, it can take anywhere from 6 months to a year. I would say I prefer a year because if you're going to write it in 6 months, you're not going to do much else in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think I can lead a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
But you really can't if you write a book that fast, or I can't.
Mm-hmm. Your main character, Detective Skip Langdon, is 6 feet tall and has somewhat of a weight problem. What other characteristics separate her from the many other mystery female sleuths in mystery fiction?
Well, I think the fact that she has a weight problem is kind of indicative of how she's different from the others, because she is really not perfect. You know, this is a girl who, actually, the thing is, she's quite tall. She's 6 feet tall. But other than that, she's really not a larger-than-life character.
Mm-hmm.
She's a very, I hope, a very realistic character. And I do portray her pretty much, warts and all, not as, she is a hero in her job, but in her personal life and in her own mind, she's just a person.
Mm-hmm. And the character in this book, Talba Willis. She's a poet. She's an aspiring private eye. She's a young African-American woman, which I read a Publisher's Weekly review on 82 Desire, and they really like this character. I'm curious how Talba came to you.
I wanted to have a private eye in the book, and I really think Talbot was almost born out of the kind of private eye that I needed. She was going to work for another private eye who becomes the victim in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a white, middle-aged male. What he really needs is a spy to go into an office and work and plant some bugs and pick up on some conversations and things like that. So he says to her, "You have the right demographics." But that's how she became young and African-American.
Mm-hmm.
The poet part kind of came later. And I honestly don't know. She just started writing poetry.
It works.
She just got away from me that way. It's funny.
This is your eighth Skip Langdon novel, and I'm curious how the process for you, the writing process, has changed since you wrote the first one. Are you more sure-footed in where you're going with the story? Are the plots coming easier, or is it more difficult as time goes on? How does the process change?
That is such an interesting question. You would think it would get easier, and I just don't think it does. I don't know if it gets harder. This book I found incredibly hard. This is maybe the hardest book I've ever written. And I can't tell you why, except that it was the corporate crime in the book involves an oil company and certain processes involved in drilling for oil. And it involves working with computers. That's another Talbot's talent, working with computers. So, and those were things I didn't know anything about. However, if you actually look at how much space they take up in the book, it may be 5 pages. Still, I felt like I kept going up against those things and not knowing how it would work, and generally behaving like a person writing their first novel.
Hmm.
I'd love to say it gets easier, but I just don't think it does.
What is your revision process like? Are you, because you so carefully plot and outline, are you pretty much there by the end of the book, or do you put it through a couple more passes?
I usually do 3 or 4 revisions. I begin... Well, I do every day. I just do a line edit, so that I've almost done a complete revision by the time I finish the book. And then I read the whole thing, and I do another line edit as I'm reading it. And while I do that, oh, actually, I came across this really good idea. One thing I forgot to mention is I do my research last. Well, I couldn't really do that with this book because of the oil stuff and the computer stuff. But usually I... What I do is I imagine what I think it would be like, and I write that, and then I run it by an expert to see if it is that.
Hmm.
Well, you'd be surprised how often I'm right,
mm-hmm.
but or how often I don't have to revise very much. Sometimes I take myself into a corner. But anyway, so I've discovered this idea, and what it is I will go through, and I mark all the questions that need to be answered and all the passages that need to be worked on with different colors of Post-its. Like all the cop questions, I use blue for. And the medical questions, I use red for blood. And any New Orleans questions are usually green, purple, or gold, because those are Mardi Gras colors. And I do it like that. And then that way I can pinpoint what I need to know from each expert. So I can call up a cop, ask all the cop questions, and then make those revisions. And as I make the revisions, I can tear off the Post-it. So that I start out with a manuscript looking like a porcupine, and then I can see, you know, the Post-its get to be fewer and fewer and fewer. I can't tell you how satisfying it is.
Mm-hmm.
Really wonderful.
It's interesting. I've heard of other writers doing their research last. Talk a bit about that. That's interesting.
Well, it's, there's an old phrase, research is endlessly beguiling, but writing is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
I find it the opposite. I think because I was a reporter for so long, I'm not very interested in going out and asking questions about something and having reams and reams of notes. I just can't wait to write.
Mm-hmm.
It's pure impatience is the reason that I do it. But I've also found it does save me a lot of work because I am quite often right about how it really would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I nearly always find that I revise it somewhat because I want it to be exactly right.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's worked out. I once read that Stephen King does that, so I felt a lot better about it. Well, some things you just have to do.
Yeah.
Up front. For instance, I couldn't make sure that the crime in this book was possible without I conceived of what the crime was, but I really couldn't go through with the book without finding out if that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, I could have ended up with the book and know that really couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there'd be very few people who know that, the people in the oil business say, but that would not be acceptable to me.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about your house's ghost and serial murder story.
Well, the serial murder story, I don't know too much about. There was a murder here, and it was apparently the first in a series of murders. But the ghost, I don't believe, is the ghost of that murdered person, because the ghost kind of smells like jasmine. We were told about the ghost when we moved in and by the previous owners. And sure enough, I have smelled a ghost many times. Of course, it's always when jasmine isn't in season. That's how you know.
Uh-huh.
And you might say, well, why would you believe such a thing? Well, I'll tell you why, because the cat freaks out. The cat just hates the ghost and just yowls into the dark.
What does the ghost do?
Nothing much. Here's the cat, you know, smells like jasmine. It's really a very peaceful ghost.
It's very interesting that that you found out there was a ghost there before you moved in, and you moved in. I think that's very interesting.
I couldn't have found a house in the French Quarter if I was worried about that.
Interesting.
Everybody has a ghost here.
Oh, that's great. Have you used it in, or do you plan to use it in your books?
No, I don't. I am not much for supernatural stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Anne Rice, I believe, has ghosts as well,
mm-hmm.
and uses those. But she does write supernatural stories. I don't quite understand supernatural stories.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem quite fair to me in a mystery.
What do you read?
I do read a lot of mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I read, actually lately I've been reading a lot of poetry.
Uh-huh.
I think because of Talba.
Oh, right.
I became very interested in poetry. I read fiction, mainstream fiction as well. And I read nonfiction mostly as it relates to my work. And that means any research that I have to do with my work. And also, I read as much psychology as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I find that very fascinating and helpful. And another thing I read, not always, it can be psychology or it could be other writings. I read about evil. I'm extremely interested in evil and what makes a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And I will read the psychological viewpoint on it. I'll read the Catholic viewpoint on it. Other kinds of religious viewpoints on it. Just to see what people think about it. And some of them, you know, it overlaps in some ways. Some ways it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their own opinion.
Yes, that's interesting. It's always interesting to know what writers are reading. Julie, we're at the end of our time. Do you have any advice for the writers listening to us tonight?
You mean unpublished writers?
Yeah.
Or I like to say pre-published writers.
Yes, pre-published.
Well, I think the best advice I could give is not to listen to advice. Because truly, everybody has their own way of working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only I could say, always outline. You must always outline. But really, that advice is only useful to people whose psychological makeup is such that they need to outline. I hate being on the edge of my chair every day, but if you thrive on that, you wouldn't want to sit down and tell your story to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just work out your own system, I think, is my best advice.
Well, Julie Smith, author of 82 Desire, I thank you so much for being on the line tonight and sharing what you know and your work with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Next week, my guest will be Los Angeles poet Eloise Klein Healy. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Thanks for listening, and get to work. Remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.